loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we spend the next half hour on our regular segment In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week and put them into perspective, including the ongoing government shutdown, which is in day 33, the successfully ended LA teacher strike, the indefinite detaining of journalist Marzia Hashemi, and the news that Julian Assange is now working to have his U.S. charges unsealed. Then, the six-day Los Angeles teacher strike ended yesterday as teachers and staff threw their support behind a new agreement negotiated with the school board. The agreement, which garnered the votes of a supermajority of union members, calls for a 6% pay raise, a gradual decrease in class sizes, and the hiring of more librarians, nurses, and counselors. And finally, Turkish President Erdogan is in Moscow today to meet with Russian President Putin on Syria. The two will discuss coordination in Syria, where they've been on opposing sides. Meanwhile, the Syrian government has floated the possibility of a retaliatory strike against Israel if it carries out another attack on the Damascus Airport. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
It's Wednesday, and that means it's time for our weekly segment called In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week so far and put them into perspective. At the end of the week, on Friday, we have the Week in Review, and we have the same panel. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Jackie Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik news analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
Day 33, that's the longest shutdown now in U.S. history. It's a partial shutdown, but still we have 800,000 federal workers and many, many private contractors who work with government agencies who haven't been paid. And when they're not paid on Friday, and I think the direct deposit happens on Thursday, that would be tomorrow. If they're not paid, that's two paychecks in a row. You just go right down the street and there are food lines. They happen every day. Jose Andreas nonprofit organization is feeding well-dressed federal workers who are coming and lining up for free food. Meanwhile, the U.S. Congress, which is by constitution, has the power of the purse, hasn't reopened the government. They're being paid. The president of the United States doesn't need to be paid because he's already amassed, I don't know, hundreds of millions or billions. Maybe it's not income. Maybe it's just debt. Nonetheless, it's his. Jackie Lookman, it's getting to be a crisis for these individuals, their families, some neighborhoods, and maybe now impacting on the larger economy.
Yeah, this is beginning to be the conundrum that Trump is facing. When you have almost 800,000 workers who are not getting paid, that is money that is not going into the economy from 800,000 people. So this is not just about impacting 800,000 people. This is about impacting the businesses that support those people at their on their jobs. Also, the businesses in their communities that their incomes support, grocery stores, mechanics, you know, dry cleaners, all kinds of things. And so I think Trump is now facing, does he stick with demanding money for this wall? And if he does, how does he explain the imminent negative impact on the economy? Or if he doesn't stick with his demands for funding for the wall and says, you know, the economy is suffering, then what does that do for his ego? And I'm afraid his ego is much bigger than reason. And always. So it's bad on all fronts.
We're going to talk about two measures that are being introduced in the Senate, one a Republican measure, one a Democratic measure, both of them likely to fail, it seems. And we want to talk about the difference. But Walter, I'm looking at a Wall Street Journal article from today, and the headline is Shutdown Poses Risk to Healthcare. Subtitle, some consumers may face higher ACA, that's the Affordable Care Act, premiums and insurers delay plans for 2020 because of staff shortages. And I'll read a couple sentences and then have you comment. The longest ever U.S. government shutdown is posing new risks to the Affordable Care Act and some health services, prompting alarm from insurers, providers, and congressional Democrats who say the impasse could harm consumers and undermine the stability of the individual insurance market. Wow, that's one part of it. There's the other part, which is ongoing staff shortages at the IRS are such that people are not being able to apply, or if they're being smart at all, not turning in their tax returns right, and applying for what they might get back. All of this does have a ripple effect.
There is a ripple effect. And another thing, too, is, you know, we've been kind of, well, I've been chuckling about complaints at TSA that TSA isn't getting paid and they're calling in sick at the airports. But this is becoming a serious problem now. It's not just TSA, the Transportation Safety Administration. It's also the air traffic controllers. People aren't getting paid. They're getting angry. They're thinking maybe it's time to look for other work. And so we don't have enough people at the airports. We don't have enough people with enough rest watching the planes or helping the planes come in. It's a safety issue. In addition, Brian, you're absolutely correct that we're not going to be able to get our tax returns processed. So if you have money coming back, you're not going to get it, at least for a while. Like you say, it's a ripple effect. It's going to impact us in areas and in ways that we haven't really considered so far.
Yeah, Walter, before the shutdown happened, we were all talking amongst ourselves. I said I didn't think the shutdown would happen. I thought it was just bluff. Again, showing people should not listen to any of my predictions, which I swore that I would not make anymore after the November 2016 election. You, Walter, however, being the sage, the wise.
Wow, thank you.
the voice of sagacity. I've been wanting to say that all day. You said, yes, you thought it would happen. Did you think it would go on this long?
No, this is like really amazing. And there's truly no sense that this is going to be coming to a conclusion soon. I mean, the people who, you know, ultimately have to make the decision about whether or not to end the government shutdown, you know, the leadership in Congress and Trump, you know, they're not personally affected by it. You know, the Congress still has their health care. You were talking about, you know, the people who rely on the Affordable Care Act, you know, not getting some of the services that they need. Congress is completely unaffected by that because their health care is great. And I think, you know, if we zoom out, you know, there's the missed paychecks, of course, that'll keep coming, you know, every 2 weeks, right? People are going to get especially upset because, you know, the a large portion of people in the United States, including federal workers, live paycheck to paycheck because of, you know, just the way that this system operates where, you know, wealth is concentrated at the top. And then in terms of the overall health of the economy, I think sort of the big point at which the situation escalates is at the beginning of March, because that's when the U.S. government reaches the debt ceiling, right? I think it's March 2nd that the, you know, the temporary lifting of the debt ceiling has to be renewed. And so if they sort of compound that on top of a government shutdown, I mean, it would be amazing if it went until March. But I mean, it looks, I don't know, it looks like it might.
And you know what? Let me interrupt you, Walter, too. The proposal that the Democrats have come up with, at least the Democrats in the House, is only to fund the government for the next 2 weeks. That's all. So if they voted on it today, the Senate voted on it today, it passed, the president signed it today, none of which is going to happen. It would only reopen the government for 2 more weeks, and then we go right back to where we are now. You raise a very important point that nobody's talking about yet, and that's the debt limit, the debt ceiling. The Democrats sponsored a bill in the House to automatically raise the debt ceiling without having to do vote after vote after vote. It does not have the support of Republicans in the Senate, so it's not going to pass into law. And so we have a double crisis on our hands. One is ending the shutdown, and the other is raising the debt ceiling, or our international bond rating is going to take a hit again, and it's going to push our economy right into a recession.
Two crises, Jackie, and both of them artificial, both of them manufactured.
That's exactly right.
There is no crisis at the U.S.-Mexican border, none at all. The number of undocumented people crossing the border is at its lowest level since 1972. There is no crisis, so Trump has made that up. Also, just for the record, the Democrats offered Trump $20 billion to pay for the wall in exchange for him rescinding his executive order that denied relief to the Dreamers, 700,000 or as many as 1.6 million young people who came to the United States as children when their families did not have legal documents. So there's a lot of politicking going on both sides. And then the debt ceiling is also a completely manufactured crisis because this is a limit imposed by Congress that didn't always exist. whereby it says in order for the government to accumulate a greater debt level would require government approval. Again, governments use debt spending and government financing beyond the revenues available from taxes all the time to stimulate the economy. And of course, the debt just went up a great deal as a consequence of Donald Trump's tax giveaway to the rich. But of course, that leads to a greater level of government debt. Again, a manufactured crisis.
Yes. Unfortunately, there are only half of the country, maybe hopefully now a little bit more than half of the country, who realizes that all of this is a manufactured crisis. But there are still too many people who are very supportive of this president because the GOP has done such a good job. Not to say that I agree with their messaging, because it, like you said, it's all been lies. It's all been misinformation and manufactured crises with the debt limit and the border issue and the immigration issue. But they have done such a good job at messaging and just repetition and driving these myths home that too many people still believe that these are issues that need to be solved. And they're perfectly fine with having the government shut down in order to force solutions that we don't need, which are only going to make the economic situation and the budget situation worse. And the competing legislation that the Democrats and the Republicans have introduced just really continue to reflect that reality. You know, the Republicans are asking for new limits on the flow of people on immigration into this country that we do not need, and they're draconian and they're just mean-spirited and evil. They're saying that they want to include changes to asylum law, which is something that Stephen Miller has advocated. And he's a horrible, horrible person, just nationalist in nature, very anti-immigrant, so that people cannot, that young people can only claim asylum in their countries. They cannot come to the United States and claim asylum, which is only there to stop the flow of people, which is not significant, into this country from Latin American and Central American countries. They also want to create a bunch of new rules for basically dismissing asylum claims, calling them frivolous, including to eliminate ways for people to obtain work authorizations. And it's just a way for them to continue to drive home their point that immigrants are a problem, that they shouldn't be allowed into this country. They're a threat to this country. And as a counter, the Democrats have like six spending bills that they're trying to negotiate that would include funding for immigration judges, more people to process asylum claims, infrastructure improvements at ports of entry that already stop 90% of the flow of drugs, and a large percentage of undocumented people where asylum claims are processed. So you see the lack of reality that is embedded in the Senate Republican legislation. And the Democratic legislation just focuses on improving the system, which has always been, really, it always kind of has been their standpoint, even though they haven't always made it very strongly.
That's the voice of Jackie Lookman with the Lookman Nation. We're also joined by Walter Smolarek and the In the News segment of Loud and Clear, where we take a look at the big issues midweek. John Kiriakou, now the Democrats and the Republicans, of course the Republicans control the Senate, are going to introduce measures to end the government shutdown. Let's talk about the difference between the two measures.
Sure. The basic differences are actually quite significant. One, the Senate bill budgets $5.7 billion for the wall. The House bill does not. Second, the Senate bill allows protections for Dreamers for a period of 3 years. The House bill contains permanent protections for Dreamers. These are the proverbial irresistible forces meeting immovable objects. And while both sides are shouting from the rooftops to the mainstream media that they're the ones trying to end this thing, neither one of these bills has any chance of passing into law. And so we're going to be no closer tomorrow to an end to the shutdown than we are today, despite the fact that these bills have been written.
There's a lot of talk, Walter. We're going to leave this subject in a moment. There's some talk, at least, within some of the mainstream media, again, including the Times and the Wall Street Journal, that while both measures will fail, it's an indicator that motion is starting to be
good point
to be visible. McConnell, up until now, has refused to introduce any measure into the Senate that the president wouldn't pass. So again, even though the Congress has control over the purse strings, the Senate said, we're not participating. There's some talk that this may be the beginning of ending the logjam.
And, you know, before Walter responds, I want to add one thing. There's a new poll out this morning by Marist that shows the president's approval rating having dropped to 37%. And 71% of Americans want the government to reopen without money to fund the wall.
What's the number?
71%. And so, I mean, Donald Trump may be a lot of things, but he's not stupid. And he reads these polls just like everybody else does. So does Mitch McConnell. And I think you're right, Brian. They're starting to peel off members of the Senate.
So it may, Walter, just be like face saving for Donald Trump. Ultimately, if he's on the losing end of this political stick, if the Democrats are gaining, which they feel they are, they're not going to relent. Even though their historic tendency is to always capitulate to the right wing, their opportunist electoral sort of desires are such that they might be able to hold out. You think it's coming to an end?
Possibly. I mean, I think
we're looking to you because you were the predictor.
I'm the only one who knows about this. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The impetus for these latest rounds of bills that were introduced, I think, was Trump's address on Saturday, right, where he sort of basically offered this deal where he would give temporary protection for people who have DACA and also TPS, temporary protected status, in return for, you know, almost $6 billion for the wall. So, I mean, that was immediately rejected, and now we have these bills sort of going through the motion. So I don't see an imminent end to it. One thing I've noticed is that talk about declaring a national emergency has kind of dropped off, and I'm not totally sure why that is. I mean, maybe it has to do with sort of the internal legal deliberations of the White House, but it seems to me like that's still a possible way out for Trump, where he's sort of declares a national emergency. Who cares if it actually frees up that much funding for his border wall? You know, it gives him the appearance of at least a partial victory.
That's the voice of prognosticator Walter Smolarek. He's also a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. We're also talking with Jacqueline Lookman. She's the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. Let's go on to another story. Yesterday, the Teachers Union approved a contract in Los Angeles. We're going to talk about this in more depth with the vice president of the union in a later segment of Loud and Clear. But Jackie Lookman, big deal. 30,000 teachers went on strike. Their morale was high. It was raining all week. That didn't dampen their enthusiasm or their morale. This looks like a very, very big win. And again, it will only be interpreted not as a win simply for teachers and students and communities in Los Angeles, but it'll be interpreted by the labor movement that the way forward, the way to win, is to go back to the traditional weapon, the tool, the instrument of the labor movement, which is the strike, something that has been sort of in decline in America.
Yeah, I mean, every time I see one of these stories about teachers unions reviving the age-old, time-tested method of bending power to the will of working people, which is a strike, I really get so excited because we keep trying every generation to figure out how to challenge power, and we actually have the tools. We know what works. And we just have to relearn these lessons over and over again. And it's great that in this past 2 years, maybe 3 years, it's been teachers that have led the charge for what really looks to me like the revitalization of the labor movement, of the union support in this country, of the workers' movement, and of civic engagement. And this is a really, really interesting story, like we talked about last week, because the LA Unified School District is second largest in the country. It's got a 70%+ Hispanic or Latino student population. Most of the teachers are Hispanic or Latino. They're also like the kids who grew up in the Mexican rights movement in LA in the 60s and 70s. So they're not just fighting for better and seem to have won a 6% raise for teachers, a gradual reduction in class sizes, the end to siphoning off money from public schools to charter schools, and a lot of other things that they asked for. But they're also modeling for this new generation of students how, not just how, but that they can fight for equality and justice for themselves. The system isn't too big to be challenged, and they're modeling for them how to do it.
John Kiriakou, there's another story, and it's going forward even today. It's a story we've covered last week and this week, and that's the arrest of this American, African-American woman who happens to be an anchor person, a journalist with Press TV. She was arrested when she touched down in St. Louis, where she and her family have lived historically. She's been compelled by virtue of arrest to be a material witness and testify before a grand jury that's happening today.
That's right. She is supposed to testify today. We don't know what the case is about because grand jury testimony is secret, but she's under a material witness warrant, which means she's not technically under arrest, but she is being detained in a federal prison cell to force her to testify. So what is this about? Is it about sanctions? Is it about politics? Who knows? The Justice Department isn't telling us, but it's still a travesty. It's still a miscarriage of justice to take this American citizen and put her in a prison cell to force her to testify when almost nobody else in the entire judicial system has to go through the same kind of thing.
And they could have subpoenaed her.
That's all they needed to do.
I mean, she's in the United States. She touched down in St. Louis. She was going to stay here for a while. She was going to make a movie, a documentary movie about the Black Lives Matter movement. It seems to me also to be a part of the war against Iran and a war against the alternative media. Go ahead, Walter.
Yeah, I think those are the two motivations for it. I mean, what else could you possibly think of that explains this unbelievably harsh treatment? And by the way, you know, her family was reporting that she was being, you know, pretty badly mistreated, for at least the first few days under FBI arrest. People were, forcibly removing her hijab,
which is a violation of federal law, by the way.
Yeah. And or refusing to serve her halal food so she couldn't really even eat other than crackers.
Which is also a violation.
Yeah. And so, right. I mean, what could the motivation be? Well, on the one hand, she's, you know, an alternative journalist who's covering issues that are completely banned from the mainstream media in the United States, and African-American journalist, for instance, who's right now working on a documentary about the Black Lives Matter movement, something that's been, you know, demonized by the mainstream corporate media in the United States. And then on the other hand, right, the United States is engaged in the renewed regime change push against Iran. It's a top foreign policy goal of the Trump administration. And so they're looking for any possible way that they can place pressure on Iran. And because this journalist, Marzia Hashmi, works for Press TV, you know, they figure that this is a way to do it.
And, you know, another thing, too, about that, I think that they put a lot of thought into this choice. I think that they targeted Marzia Hashmi in particular because she's an American citizen. She's a convert to Islam. She was born in the United States. And by arresting her rather than an Iranian citizen or an Iranian-born naturalized American, you completely shut the Iranian government out of consular affairs. And so the Iranians have no legal standing to lodge a complaint with the U.S. government about her incarceration, because she's an American citizen. She was born an American citizen. All they can do is complain, oh, they've arrested one of our journalists, but it carries less political weight. So I think a lot of thought went into this targeting inside the Justice Department.
A premeditated assault against her and against an alternative media.
Walter, there's been a development in the Julian Assange case just today. Julian and his attorneys have petitioned the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights to file a lawsuit in the United States in the Eastern District of Virginia that would, if successful, force the U.S. government to unseal the charges against him. Julian doesn't know what he's been charged with, and it's only by accident that we know that there are any charges at all. Everybody assumes those charges are espionage charges. But what do you make of this lawsuit?
Yeah, well, I hope that they succeed. I mean, it's definitely ridiculous that Julian Assange is facing these, you know, secret charges. And it really, I mean, the whole campaign against Julian Assange just makes a mockery of you know, the right to a free trial, right? I mean, you know, here's Assange, who's not a U.S. citizen, right? He's Australian. He's in the U.K. in an Ecuadorian embassy. And the United States is going to great lengths to basically get him kicked out of that embassy so that he can then be extradited to the United States and they can, you know, subject him to whatever ridiculous legal proceedings that, you know, would be completely stacked against them. And so shedding more light on exactly what the U.S. government has in mind, I think, is extremely important for the good of the public. And so I hope that this strategy succeeds.
Interestingly, in this lawsuit, the petition, this is the petition I'm talking about that would lead to the lawsuit. Julian's lawyers also make a complaint against the Ecuadorian government. Now, as you said a second ago, Julian is in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He's been there for 6 years. But it says the lawyer's petition calls on the IACHR, quote, to compel Ecuador to cease its espionage activities against Mr. Assange. We know that the Ecuadorians have installed cameras that cover literally every inch of the interior of their embassy. We know that they turn Julian's access to the internet on and off at will. They screen his visitors. Indeed, they ban many of his visitors. What do you make of these espionage activities?
Right. Well, the government of Ecuador did a complete change after the recent election where Lenin Moreno became the president. Moreno was actually promoted by the former government of Rafael Correa as sort of the natural successor, the person who would ensure continuity in terms of the progressive policies, the independent foreign policy orientation. But Moreno ended up to be basically a traitor. And as soon as he got into office, he made a deal with the right wing. He began cozying up to the United States. And, you know, it's clear that he intends to find some way to get Julian Assange out of the Ecuadorian embassy. I think it makes a pretty big mockery of democracy. I mean, the people of Ecuador voted for Moreno thinking that he was one thing, and then he decided to go turn around and do something completely different. And now, even though they haven't, you know, yet been able to kick Julian Assange out in large part because of the mobilization of his supporters all around the world, they now find themselves in a position where, well, maybe we can harass Julian Assange or we can spy on him.
That seems to be the case. And, you know, an interesting point about Moreno is that this was not a change in policy that came gradually. He said one thing, he got elected, he did the opposite thing. So it's not that, this is my own analysis, that he didn't have a slow change of heart. He just lied or dissembled and then decided to work with the Americans against Julian, probably in exchange for something, whether it was trade concessions or aid or whatever it is, it seems like the fix is in.
Oh, yeah. Well, I totally agree with that. I mean, I think that what Moreno did was just, I mean, he was concealing his position. It wasn't like an evolution of his position.
Anyway, we were joined from Washington, D.C. by Jackie Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The six-day Los Angeles teacher strike ended yesterday as teachers and staff threw their support behind a new agreement negotiated with the school board. The agreement, which garnered the votes of a supermajority of union members, calls for a 6% pay raise, a gradual decrease in class sizes, and the hiring of more librarians, nurses, and counselors. We're joined from Los Angeles by Cecily Maillart-Cruz. She's been a teacher in the LA Unified School District for 23 years, and she's the vice president of United Teachers Los Angeles National Education Association, the teachers union. Congratulations and welcome back, Cecily.
Thank you both.
Cecily, at first glance, it looks like the union got everything that it was working toward. You got a pay raise, but more importantly, class sizes will come down and there will be more librarians, nurses, and counselors. Do you feel like the teachers got everything that they wanted?
I think that this was a huge historic win for us. Of course, we didn't get everything we wanted, but the strike did exactly what it was supposed to do. We took our power back and won a great contract. Having members go out for 6 days and one contract cannot solve 40 years of disinvestment in our classrooms. Over the last week, through the power of collective action and community support, we have learned to raise our hopes and our expectations of what we can do. We won this strike for our students and ourselves, but more importantly, most importantly, the fight still continues. We're going to be resilient because it's not over. We have to own this moment and the movement to save public education.
Cecily, part of the struggle here was also the public teachers union taking a stand for public education. And talk about this settlement and its impact on the momentum away from public schools and towards charter schools.
Right. So, I mean, it addresses the major issues impacting our schools, our profession, our students. And there are so many great things within this contract that we have to be proud of. One, we were international. We were the international, local, state, and national news story for 6 days. We put privatization on the map like never before. People are talking about privatization and what it does to the very foundation of public education. We took a major blow at the privatizers and billionaires that have been siphoning money from our public schools and our public spaces for so long that this is a victory. So around school funding, like I said, it's been a disinvestment for the last 40, 50 years, that actual school funding and lower class sizes have been on the brains, hearts, and minds of community, of organizations, of educators, students, and parents in this fight. It is just beautiful to see that we are coalescing in a moment in time now that we can never go back to.
We're speaking with Cecily Maillart-Cruz. She is a longtime teacher in the Los Angeles Unified School District, and she's also the vice president of United Teachers Los Angeles National Education Association, which is the teachers' union in LA. Cecily, I wanted to call your attention to something on the union's website that I think is very important, and that is the victory that you earned in class size. You're getting an immediate reduction of 7 students in secondary math and English classes. More importantly, you've won the complete elimination of what's called Section 1.5, which had previously allowed the district to unilaterally ignore class size averages and caps on class sizes. Now, it seems to me this is going to just completely revolutionize this issue of class sizes in LA. Are you seeing this as one of the major victories?
It is a major victory because it has been the district's escape clause for the last 25 years where the district, you know, says they're broke on purpose and keeps piling students on into our classrooms. And this Section 1.5 has been eliminated. It's just like the wildest dream has come true because the district can no longer have this escape clause. And it really forces the state, it forces our district, and it also forces the state to start really dealing with lowering the class sizes wholesale locally as well as statewide.
Yes, let's just talk about some of the other elements of the new tentative contract. A commitment to reduce testing by 50%. That's huge. Talk about that.
You know, our educators are brilliant. They got into this profession because they love teaching. And at the end of the day, teachers want to teach. They don't want to test. Teachers can come up with their own authentic assessments. They do that with efficacy every single day. having extra tests burdening our classroom takes away from art, takes away from PE, takes away from STEM and STEAM and science and all of those other music, things that folks want to teach but can't because they have all of this unnecessary testing. So to cut testing by 50%, oh my gosh, it is just, it is so great.
I'm looking, John, at the union website. Mm-hmm. This is utla.net. People should go there and check it out for themselves. A much-deserved 6% pay raise with no contingencies.
But it's 3% retroactively and 3% for next year. And I wonder if that's going to be enough and if there will be additional pay raises beyond the next year.
Right. So with the pay raise, it's the 3% retro for 2017-2018 and then 3% retro to July 1st. And then everything after that, it's 6% straight across the board. So that is a great, having this, I mean, we need to have a cost of living adjustment. Of course, our members deserve more money. So that's no question. But to have a pay piece that has no contingencies is remarkable because the district wanted contingencies with health benefits and pension added to this. So having no contingencies is a win.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah. Again, Cecily is the vice president of the union. This amazing union hasn't gone on strike for decades. 30,000 teachers went on strike. 30,000. You had just such energy last week. You had the people, the teachers, coming out and doing, as the union president said, using their own creativity individually and collectively that made all of these bonds with the community. It's like when we always hear this slogan, the power is in the people or power to the people. People don't really think of that. They think of government power, institutional power. But when the people actually start to move and move together, you see and feel that power, right?
Yes, it was really electrifying because the first day of the strike, and I think I talked to you then, first day of the strike, January 14th, it was a torrential downpour. And some people said, oh my gosh, no one is going to walk in this torrential downpour. Our superintendent said, there's only 3,500 people out there. And when we all came downtown, the police stopped counting at 50,000, and we know they lowball the numbers, and we have 50,000 people in torrential rain with creative signs. It was record rain that day, and people were out there. They were wet, they were cold, they were tired, but they wanted action. And the collective action and the collective spirit that came about just propelled us this whole week. 3 days that we came downtown Los Angeles as a collective put over 50,000. And on Friday, it put 60,000 people in the street.
Well, if this isn't a lesson in the efficacy of organized labor in today's economy, I don't know what is.
Right. You have to prove it in practice. And that's what the LA teachers just did. This is the new face of the labor movement.
That's right.
Militant teachers, largely women-led professions who are going out. A new day for labor. A really new day.
We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. We were joined from Los Angeles by Cecily Meyert-Cruz. She has been a teacher in the LA Unified School District for 23 years, and she's the vice president of United Teachers Los Angeles, part of the National Education Association, the Teachers Union. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Turkish President Erdogan is in Moscow today to meet with Russian President Putin on Syria. The two will discuss coordination in Syria, where they've been on opposing sides. Meanwhile, the Syrian government has floated the possibility of a retaliatory strike against Israel if it carries out another attack on the Damascus airport. We're joined from Beirut by Mohammed Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. And we're joined from the UK by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former UK ambassador to Syria. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Ambassador Ford, let's start with you. This is not the first time that Erdogan and Putin have met to discuss Syria. What makes this meeting any different? And do you expect anything substantive to come out of it?
Yeah, this is probably the most crucial meeting so far because it comes in the wake of Trump's unexpected decision to pull out the U.S. Troops. And what is the immediate issue that they're going to discuss right now? I think the meeting is happening right now as we speak, is the Turkish desire to create a buffer zone, a 20-mile wide deep buffer zone, which they describe as a safe zone, and from which they, the Turks, with Turkish forces, would like to exclude the forces of the Kurdish militia. Now, this is a crazy idea, but it's something that Erdogan has nailed his flag to and is going to need some help in climbing down. So I think the discussions are going basically to be about how to save Turkish face, to discuss some possible compromise, not Turkish forces, but somebody else. But in the end, inevitably, I believe, ending up with what the Russians want, which is that the Syrian government forces should reestablish control in what is part of sovereign Syria.
Yeah, Mohammed Mirandi, how do you see this? And do you think that there's a role for the Iranian government here?
The Iranians are trying to establish a link between the Syrian government and the Turkish government. And ever since the coup in Turkey and the increased presence of the United States in Syria, as well as since the ongoing hostility between Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and Turkey, began, Iran-Turkish relations have improved substantially. So Iran is in a position to help push these two countries closer to each other. Of course, Erdogan hates President Assad, and of course, the feeling is mutual. But ultimately, as the ambassador rightly pointed out, the Turkish occupation of Syria is not really a solution. It is going to be. It would be costly for Turkey. It would be a major security problem for the country. And this is at a time when the Turks have elections coming up in a couple of months. But also, the economy is not doing well, and the Turkish government is facing multiple challenges on different fronts. So, the smartest way forward would be for the Turkish government and the Syrians to somehow come to an agreement where the Syrians go back and retake their lost sovereignty in the northwestern part of in the northeastern part of the country. And I think ultimately that's going to happen. Even if the Turks attempt some sort of occupation, it's only going to bring about trouble for the Turks themselves.
Ambassador Peter Ford, let's follow up on that point that Mohammed Mirandi is making. What will the Kurds do, or the Syrian Democratic Forces, as they are branded at this moment? They have tens of thousands of fighters, threatened by Turkey on one side. There's been negotiations and discussions, and we've talked with you about the possibility of the de facto sort of understanding between the Assad government and the Syrian Democratic Forces when it came to fighting ISIS might develop further into some sort of long-term arrangement. If that was true, in other words, if the Syrian government reclaims sovereign control over this area with some agreement with the Kurds related to maybe not autonomy, but some sort of forms of self-governance within the context of a larger Syria, would that be satisfactory for Erdogan?
In the end, Erdogan won't have much choice, frankly. His idea of creating a Turkish police buffer zone, a safe zone, is impractical. It would not be a safe zone. It would be a danger zone. Let's not forget that currently that border is quiet. Even the Turks are not claiming that it's not quiet. They're just talking about potential incursions. or that proposal, if it was implemented, would create a new seam line 20 miles into Syria between the Turks and the Kurds, which would become 100 flashpoints. The idea is absolutely crazy. It's about helping Erdogan to climb down with reassurances that Turkish concerns will be taken seriously. I dare say at some point the Russians will offer the services of their military police, although it's a very, very long border, a couple of hundred miles, so those police would be very thinly stretched, but we're talking about fig leaves here. It's significant that yesterday, reportedly, a Kurdish delegation went to Moscow. So they're obviously deep in discussions about the detail of an agreement between the Kurds and the Syrian government. The Kurds are trying to play hardball. In my personal opinion, they're overplaying their hand. If they're not careful, they'll lose everything. But hopefully in the next couple of days, things will crystallize and we'll see an announcement that agreement is close between the Syrian government and the Kurds, and that this will contain provisions which will give adequate satisfaction to Turkey.
That's the voice of Ambassador Peter Ford. Peter Ford was the UK's ambassador to Syria. We're also speaking with educator, historian, scholar Mohammed Mirandi. We're talking to Mohammed from Tehran. Mohammed, the Trump administration has been accused of adopting a, quote, isolationist position with its surprised announcement of withdrawing 2,000-plus U.S. troops from Syria. Even the new National Intelligence Review that just came out this morning, authored by Dan Coats, basically sounds the alarm about dangerous isolationist tendencies in Western countries. They're not clearly talking about the UK or France or Germany. They must be talking about the United States itself. And yet the United States has 54,000 troops in 12 Middle Eastern countries. And military bases in seven of them. That's according to a BBC Arabic report. That doesn't sound isolationist, no matter what happens with 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the Americans are obviously not being isolationist under Trump. And when we look at what's happening in Venezuela as we speak, it's obvious that the Americans are not making any such move, which would be actually welcome across the world. It would be better for the United States. It would cost less for the American population, and it would create a much more favorable atmosphere towards the United States across the globe. The problem that the United States has is the fact that its forces are based in most countries across the globe, and that the United States is constantly threatening countries. It's constantly using drones to illegally bomb people in different countries, and the fact that it's invaded country after country, and now it's tried to undermine the Venezuelan government. If the United States behaved as a ordinary nation, a powerful nation, a nation with a very powerful high tech industry, and with a large market, I think that it would see that it would find many new friends across the board, including Iran. But as things stand, the United States has to spend a great deal of its energy in sustaining a very unwelcome hegemony.
Mohammed Mirandi, you're right about Venezuela. I'm just actually, as we're speaking, there's breaking news statement from Donald J. Trump recognizing the Venezuelan National Assembly President Juan Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela. So Donald Trump has just announced who the president of Venezuela is, and it's not the president of Venezuela, which would be Nicolas Maduro. Again, Peter, the sense of imperial hubris seems boundless to me. And yet when you come back to where we're talking about the war in Syria, hubris, arrogance, the mantra from 2011 on, Assad must go, it directly confronts the reality that the U.S. doesn't have undiluted power. And in fact, in Syria, that undiluted power has been not only checked, it has failed.
Well, absolutely. If the withdrawal of 2,000 troops is isolationism, Well, bring it on, I say. Let's have more isolationism. Anyway, this term isolationism is just meant to be derogatory, when in fact what we're talking about is simply anti-interventionism. Trump doesn't like interventionism as much as many of his, all his predecessors and nearly all his advisors. He's not an interventionist guy. He's a transactionist. He looks for benefit from the United States. And he really is the smartest guy in the room. Admittedly, the bar is low. But, you know, when he says that by our interventions in Syria, we've helped crushing ISIS, we've helped Syria, Iran, and Russia, he is right. Actually, he is right. Historians will look back with disbelief that the U.S. and its coalition allies expended so much effort, national treasure, and resources in eradicating an ISIS that could have been dealt with relatively easily by the Syrian army. So they've done it, and Syria will inherit ISIS III lands in the fairly near future. So Trump gets it right. His experts get it wrong.
In the last 90 seconds, I wanted to ask Mohammad Mirandi, but then what happens if the Israelis decide to jump in? What happens if the Israelis make some sort of a provocation, if they attack Damascus Airport again, or they launch rockets into the country? How does that change the status quo?
And the Syrian government has just said if they attack the Damascus Airport one more time, the Israelis, Damascus will hit the airport in Tel Aviv.
Well, first of all, there's been a lot of misinformation over the last couple of days in the Western media. The Israeli regime did not strike Iranian forces. In fact, the only clip that we see that the Israelis have given out is one where a vehicle that belongs to Syrian Air Defense is struck. And under that, you see Western media say Iranian positions targeted. The Israelis have not targeted Iranians for a very long time. And therefore, I think they are just using Iran as a scapegoat or as an excuse to strike Syrian government positions to weaken them. But I don't think that in the long term this serves Israeli interests or Western interests, because this is simply showing the Arab world that the Syrian government is the only government that stands up to Israeli aggression. It strengthens the argument of Hezbollah that it should have a strong military force in the south, especially since Israel is using Lebanese airspace illegally to attack Syria. And it shows Israel to be a regime that is provocative and aggressive because it keeps striking Syria, whereas Syria has never struck the Israeli regime.
That was the voice of Mohammad Mirandi, who joined us from Tehran. He's an expert on American studies and postcolonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. And we were joined from the UK by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former UK ambassador to Syria. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.